as I said a minute ago, it's sweeping through, it's a new form of presumed worship that is sweeping through North America, and it's Mother Church, so to speak, the Vatican of all that, is the Community Church of Joy in Phoenix, Arizona. And you from that church, maybe not. It's a Lutheran church. It's a Lutheran church, and it's a form of worship, presumably, that is infecting and being popular in a lot of the mainline churches, not just Lutheran, but Presbyterian and Anglican and Methodist and so on. And I want to offer a critique of it today. But let's go up and back up for a minute and think in terms of the last couple of days. Were some of you with me the last couple of days? A couple of you were.
Yeah.
I laid out on Monday, incidentally, interrupt me along the way, feel free, and I'll try to leave some time at the end when we can have some discussion. Anyhow, the first time we met, which would have been Monday? Yes, I think Monday. I laid out the difference between ritual and routine. And I said that ritual is something that you do repeatedly that you would miss if you did not do it. And routine is something that you do repeatedly that you would not miss if you did not do it, like taking out the garbage. But ritual is part of human nature. And I would argue that people are liturgy and actors. And if we are not using the liturgy of the Green Book or the liturgy of the Judeo-Christian tradition, then we're using some other liturgy. And I would even argue that atheists and agnostics and secularists have their own rituals and their own liturgies, which make sense out of their lives and give their lives meaning and purpose and direction and so on. So, people are by nature, human beings are by nature, ritual and actors. I would argue that toe-to-toe with anybody. And so the question is not, shall we have liturgy or shall we not have liturgy? The question is, what liturgy? And I think the one in the Green Book is pretty good. And I think what we have received through our grandparents is pretty good. I gave the definition of tradition on Monday, I think it was Monday, as giving your grandfather and grandmother a vote in the decisions you must make today. That's the definition of tradition. Transgenerational democracy. You don't give grandpa and grandma the only vote, you don't give them the deciding vote necessarily, but you do give them a voice and a vote. And you want to honor what your parents and grandparents honored. As much as possible, at least I think you do. To be a mature human being, to be a mature Christian today, does not mean throwing out the past. It means trying to embrace the past and trying to find out what your grandparents loved and try to love that as well. Now, you may not be able to love everything that your grandparents loved. My mother and dad grew up in a household full of Victorian furniture from their parents. And they hated, when they got married, my father and mother hated Victorian furniture. Guess what my house is full of? Victorian furniture. You know, this thing kind of leaps a generation sometimes. And it's the grandchildren who go to appreciate what grandpa and grandma had. Peter Berger pointed that out long ago. So it sometimes skips a generation.
You know why?
And what's that?
Do you know why?
Can you tell us?
Well, because you have to get far enough away from it to appreciate it.
That could be part of it, yeah. And part
of it,
maybe,
children were too close.
Good point.
To really look at it objectively, yeah. Because it's our desire to, in so many cases, be different.
Yeah. When we started out in our married life, my wife and I, we were very fond of Scandinavian modern. And if I were starting out today, I think it would be Scandinavian, you know, very simple, austere, wonderful, elegant design, but very, very unfussy. But as it happens through the years, people have been giving us Victorian antiques, And as a result, we have a house full of Victorian antiques, now very few of which we bought. We didn't buy much of it. But we got marble top tables, we got bead gauze and gingerbread and all that. And I have come to love it. I mean, it's really wonderful stuff. The Victorian era, you see, was experimenting with the new industrial revolution and the power lathe and the power jigsaw, and they tried to see all the fancy stuff they could do with wood, with a lathe, and with jigsaw. So you have all this fretwork and all these spindles and all this gingerbread and so on. It's wonderful. I think it's very exuberant and very neat, but it's terrible to dust.
Yeah.
And it's not my spirit. I mean, if I were to design something now, it would be very simple and modern and Scandinavian. But the Victorian stuff I've come very much to love. Anyhow, let us take a look then at what we said yesterday and the day before in terms of the things that ritual does. Ritual is action. Jesus in the upper room says, "Do this in remembrance of me." So it's not chiefly words. It's not chiefly a verbal thing. It's an enacted thing. Worship, ritual, is chiefly enacted. It is corporate. It's not just private. It's not just me and Jesus, or you and Jesus, but it's us and Jesus. So I've got to trim my personality and my prejudices, and you've got to trim your personality and your prejudices so as to be able to make this a corporate voice of praise. So, it's action, it's corporate, it allows you to act out what is most significant in human life. That's the whole point of ritual. It allows you to enact what is most important to you. And I gave the example of the peace. When I was a kid, my dad just said, my dad was a pastor, and he said, "The peace of the Lord be with you," and we also said, we said back, "And also with you," but we didn't do anything, we just stood there, and the service went on. But now we're invited, following the pattern of the ancient church, actually to greet one another and embrace or shake hands, say hello to your neighbor. And it's not just hello, it's the peace of the Lord that you're granting. It's performative language. So we're acting out what is most significant and what is most important to us. It involves the total person, I maintained on Monday, and I think that's true. It's not just left brain, it's not just linear, it's not just verbal, but it is the whole person. Right brain as well as left brain, emotional as well as intellectual, imaginational, and all that stuff that's metaphoric and so on. All that feeds your spirit, your senses, your sight, your smell, your taste, your touch, your hearing, all of those senses are involved, and we don't have to apologize for that. Therefore, the last thing I said about ritual, it uses metaphors, it uses figures of speech, it uses symbols to make its point. And a fundamentalist I described as a person who has a hard time dealing with metaphors and the figures of speech. But figures of speech and symbols and so on, that's the language of liturgy, that's the language of prayer. Okay, so much for what liturgy or ritual does. I also spelled out what I took to be the main elements of our tradition. And our tradition, what Grandpa and Grandma gave us, is, in a sense, contained in this green book, and it includes a biblical reference. I use the word Catholic, small c, not big C, but small c, Catholic meaning pertaining to the whole. Our tradition is Catholic in that sense. It's whole, it's universal. It's not sectarian, but it's complete in all its parts at its best. It is a confessional tradition. Lutherans are different from Methodists, and that's kind of nice. I mean, Methodists have something to teach Lutherans, I think. And Lutherans have something to teach Methodists. And so it is with all the major Christian groups. We've got something to teach one another, and those confessional traditions are important. It's national, it's parochial, it has to do with the parish, and it's personal. So that's our tradition. And I think it's a good tradition. We don't have to apologize for it. It's a tradition that has fed the spiritual life of generations of Christians, and this happens to be the current version of it. It's not the only version of it, but it's the current Lutheran version of it. And I don't think we have to apologize for it. I think it's a splendid tradition. And it was prepared, this book was prepared to answer The critique, well, let's make it contemporary. Let's bring it up to date. If you remember the book that preceded this, it was a red book in both of our traditions, I think. That book had these and thous and beseech and vouchsafe and all that stuff, and people don't talk that way anymore. So this book throws out that language, and I think wisely so. We talk about God, you. That's the way the Hebrews did it. That's the way Jesus did it. There was no special language for God or special language for religion. It was the language of every day. So this book uses the language of every day. Anyhow, that tradition, as I say, we don't have to apologize for. Now, yesterday I talked something about the arts in worship, and we got into architecture and action and words and music and vestments and that kind of thing to a degree. I won't go back over that right now, but we might want to pick that up tomorrow. Today I want to talk about worship as quote-unquote theater. A couple of months ago now, come to think of it, there was a festival of the arts at the school where I teach, and every year the theme of the festival is different, but the festival theme this year was the actor's craft. And we have a school of business and economics at our university, so the school of business put on some workshops, the actor's craft as it relates to business and to sales. And there's a wonderful school of music where I serve, and they had a couple of workshops on the musician as performer. And I was on the committee, and I said, gee, I'll do a workshop on Christian worship as theater. Because if you want to look at it from one perspective, the people who are leading worship are producers and directors and actors in a drama. You know, we have to concern ourselves with architectural space, environmental space. We have to concern ourselves with costumes, vestments, action, how I stand, you know, all that body language stuff, how I project my voice. I have to learn something about that from speech people. All of that is very exciting to me. I love theater, as you may have guessed already. And, you know, I was Polonius last year when we did Hamlet on campus, and I love that, and I was King Arthur and Camelot and all the rest of it. Anyhow, it was lots of fun, and it still remains a part of my life. And there's a sense in which Sunday morning, when I'm up front as a pastor, I have to call on those skills and those abilities and those techniques in order to be an effective worship leader. But Soren Kierkegaard, who is a great Lutheran philosopher and theologian, has given us a warning about worship as theater. And he says, most church buildings do not help. He says, most church buildings are axial, arranged along an axis. And if you gave people an oblong room or even a square room, you'd probably push the table against the wall as an altar, and you'd rank up the seats like this, like a theater. And you might even have a platform that separates the performers, so to speak, from the audience. And I'll bet, I'm not sure whether they ever had worship here at Holden Village back in the mining days, but you know how there's a stage over there with a curtain? I'll bet in the old days they put an altar up on that stage and the people sat ranked on rank facing that stage. Now, how has Holden Village arranged its worship space? Quite different, right? They've taken out the stage, or they just ignore it, and they put the altar on a platform here, and people are sitting like that, radial instead of axial. Now, you could argue that each has its place. Axial type of worship makes one think of marching to the Promised Land, marching to Jerusalem with the generals and the lieutenants up ahead of us. Nothing wrong with that image. And Jesus way out in front, like a mighty army, moves the church of God with the cross of Jesus marching on before, you know, armored Christian soldiers. But this is a nice arrangement too. radio or half radio, because it suggests imminence, it suggests God in the midst of us. The old, what I would call axial arrangement, boy, this pen is drying out, you know, that suggests a movement in this direction. And the transcendent, the unknown, the God whom we worship, is out here somewhere in mystery. Whereas here, God is in the midst of us. And you could argue both. I mean, Martin Luther loved to talk about this stuff. The little baby in the manger that has messy diapers. You know, that's God for us. Anyhow, you could argue that both have their place. However, most church buildings until very recently were not of this variety, but they were more of this variety, and as I maintained yesterday, actually became two-room spaces. Boy, that's a terrible pun. Two-room spaces. This space was for the clergy, and this space was for the rest of the common folks. And in some cases, there was actually a screen here separating the two rooms. The altar behind the screen, where the people down here couldn't see it, didn't matter much in those days. I mean, this is medieval, right? Now, what else do you have when you have this arrangement? Well, you have the impression that this is a stage, even if there's no screen here, you see, even if there's no curtain. This gives the impression of being a stage, with this as the audience, and here are performers. And says Kierkegaard in this analogy, it's as if, according to this arrangement, according to this architectural setting, it's as if these people are an audience watching these people perform. These people are an audience watching a performance that the pastor and the musician and the choir and the worship leaders are putting on for them. And God is here in the wings whispering cues every now and then. Now, that's the picture that a lot of people get about Christian worship. But, says Søren Kierkegaard, it is the wrong picture. Because the right picture is this. We are all invited on stage. And all of us are actors. This is why this other arrangement makes a lot of sense today, to think in terms of all of us on stage. You may have seen theater like this too. Have you been to the Tyrone Guthrie in Minneapolis with the Thrust stage? Or the Stratford Theatre in Ontario, again, a stage right out in the midst of the people. And that encourages the people to be part of the production. So, whether you have this kind of an arrangement or this kind of arrangement doesn't make any difference. You have the same problem, that is to say, trying to encourage the people not to think of themselves as an audience, but to think of themselves as performers. And people who come to worship ought to come with the invitation that they are invited on stage. Okay, what about the worship leaders and the musicians and the choir and so on? They're the prompters. They're in the prompter's box whispering the cues every now and then. The most important voice of praise is the voice of the people. And the pastors and the worship leaders are there to enable. They're the cheerleaders, if you want to change the analogy. They're the cheerleaders for the team, and we're all mixing it up on the field. We're all on the team. We're none of us in the stands. We're all actors on the stage, or we're all the team on the field. We went to had our church convention a week ago in Canada, and the presiding bishop was up there. We don't call him presiding bishop, we just call him bishop, but I mean that's what he is. And he's presiding at that convention, not to get his own will across, but to enable the will of the convention. And Robert's rules of order and all that are established so that the convention can speak. Not the bishop, but the convention. Now, the same thing here. The pastors, the musicians, the choir, the worship leaders, they are the prompters that help the people do their praise. And they're also among the actors in the drama. And who's in the audience? God. It's God who's in the audience. And God is the critic writing the final review. And God is an actor on stage, too, and our analogy begins to disintegrate as soon as we get all mixed up like that. But I think it's worth remembering that in Christian worship, everybody who walks in the door is invited to be a performer. Now, you may not want to be. And as I said yesterday, you may want to sit in the back. There are good reasons why Lutherans sit in the back of churches. Not just Lutherans, but a lot of others as well. They don't want to get involved, don't want to get committed. Terrible. You should sit in the front row. you're part of the action. You're a performer on stage. Now,
excuse me.
That in oh, the yes, go ahead.
I just want to make one comment that you may be implying, at least to me, but you may not think so, that you're sort of good. You know, the architecture is what's determining the audience versus the leader.
A lot of times it does, unfortunately.
But I'm just, you know, it doesn't have to.
No.
And, you know, we have a service in our church, and we're the one.
It's like this.
We're on the one on the right there, but uh-huh. It's where the choir members are sitting in the audience.
Ah, wonderful.
And then get up in front. The Bible, the scripture readers and all that kind of stuff are sitting in the audience, and they stand up in front. And,
terrific.
And then they're, where they're speaking from and where they're singing from is just almost right at the front row point there.
Yeah.
As opposed to in the back mm-hmm. or up high. It's all mm-hmm. at the same level. And the ushers, for instance, though, when they take the offering, they're not sitting at the back or standing there. They're sitting anywhere. I mean, sometimes it looks a little out of control, but...
I must say, sometimes, if I think I can get away with it, and I'm preaching in a church, and everybody's sitting in the back, I will walk right down the aisle, shamelessly, and talk to them. You're going to sit in the back? Okay, I'll come to you. I think we have to do that. And I've been to Coventry Cathedral. Any of you been to Coventry Cathedral in England? You know what a magnificent building it is. It's long and narrow. It's really it's a medieval building, but it's built in a modern style, you might say. But it's long. Let me use a blue one, see if that's any better. It's long and narrow. Oh, Lord, first. Green, try green. It's, oh, my Lord, we need to get all of these people. Coventry Cathedral is long and narrow, like a medieval cathedral. And the altar is way back here. And they have a Dickens of a time. They have the preaching out here, as close to the people as they can be. They try everything they can. I spoke to people who were in charge there, and you know, everybody's racked up, and all you see is the back of somebody else's head. I think it's quite unfortunate in a day when we're trying to encourage community to look at the back of somebody's head. And most of our churches are still designed this way. Now, if I were in charge, you know, if the world were the way I want to design it, I would try to have maybe the altar here, you know, something like that. I don't know. You have to take each building as you find it and do what you can with it, not, you know, being sensitive to the architectural integrity of the building. In any case, what I would call the ritual contract in worship. The contract is, what do you expect when you walk in the door? Well, the contract ought to include this invitation to be on stage. If you're a worshiper in a Christian service, you ought to come in the door and expect to perform. Not necessarily so, but you're expected to sing, to pray, to stand, to come forward, to eat, to drink, to digest, as I said on Monday. That's all part of your ritual contract. The contract that you have with God and with the other people there is to perform, to be an actor on stage. As I have said, that means that worship leaders and planners are producers, directors, actors, and so on. And Christian worship, therefore, is a complex of all of these roles and ministries. There's the ministry of the people, there's the ministry of the preacher, there's the ministry of the pastor or presider, there's the ministry of assisting minister. That's real neat. That's a new thing in this book. As I said on Monday, when I was a kid, my dad was pastor, and he did everything up front. Led the prayers, read the scriptures, preached, everything. Now, in the book, we have the possibility of other people sharing that leadership. At least we should have lay people reading the scriptures every Sunday. We should have lay people as assisting ministers holding the book and leading the prayers and so on. ushers, that's a special ministry. Musicians, that's a special ministry. Choir, that's a special ministry. Acolytes, that's a special ministry. Great, we need all of those people, and I say put them to work. Now, there is a new movement. It's not so new, it's as old as a Baptist revival tent meeting. But you'll meet it sooner or later in your community. And it began, among Lutherans anyhow, at the Community Church of Joy in Phoenix, Arizona. And they're taking their show on the road now, I should say. They're offering workshops in other parts of the country. Any of you know this church or been to it? You've seen it reviewed maybe in the Lutheran press and other places. It began presumably with a couple of hundred members 6 or 8 years ago, and now it's got 6,000 members, and they're going to build a great big campus, Crystal Cathedral, like Robert Schuller or whatever. Anyhow, the secret of their success, and you have to say they have success in terms of numbers, the secret of their success is what we are calling entertainment evangelism. Now, a lot of the leaders of this movement are now beginning to disown that term because it can be misleading, and I want to grant them that. If they want to use a different term, they may. But the idea is this. We want to attract baby boomers, for the most part, middle class, white, Anglo-Saxon baby boomers, and baby boomers do not want to participate. They've found studies, demographical studies, presumably sociological studies, that say that baby boomers want to be entertained. They don't want to commit themselves, they want to sit there and be entertained. So, they design worship in such a way that it's an entertainment. And quite frankly, the people who come and sit in the pews are audience. And the people up on the platform are, quite frankly, entertainers. I was at the Community Church of Joy last year, and again, one visit does not make me an expert on the field. And please forgive me, Community Church of Joy, if I'm misrepresenting you. I don't mean to misrepresent you. But I was there, and what you're apt to find is the pastor, for instance, in his cities, open shirt and tie and Florida tan, chatting up people at the door before people come in, a little rock band practicing up on the stage with, and that's what it is, a stage, with boomers and tweeters and microphones and all that. There was a broken processional cross standing over against this corner. It needed to get repaired and get straightened up, but it stood over there in the corner. The service began with five energetic people coming out and singing with handheld cordless phallic microphones. There's going to be a revival in the land with lots of energy. A couple of pastors bounded out again, no vestments, but the slacks and sport shirt, and they welcomed us all and chatted us up. I don't think they had a celebrity that day, but they could have, like Robert Schuller chats up whoever. They had a little drama that a couple of people ran out of the congregation and put on a very skillful, very simple little 5-minute drama that talked about Christian stewardship, that kind of thing. They read one passage of scripture, a couple of verses from the book of Romans, and one of the pastors preached on the subject, again with a handheld mic pacing down in front, no pulpit, no lectern, talking to the people very conversationally. He was dynamite preaching. He was an excellent preacher, and it was a fine sermon, and it was the gospel. Again, a couple more choruses, a couple of prayers of the Jesus We Just variety. Have you heard of that? Jesus, we just want to thank you for I don't mean to be making fun of these people. I guess I'm making fun of them. They were not classic prayers, let's put it that way, or prayers in the classic tradition. We, in the pews, were invited to participate in the space of an hour's time. We were invited to participate at two places in the service. We were invited to join these five singers in one chorus of a song. And at the end of the service, they prayed the Lord's Prayer, old version, you can be certain, old translation, and we were invited to join that too. The rest of the time we sat there, and we were audience at a performance. I can't remember if it's benediction or not, but there might have been. They had many, many committees and Bible studies and, what do I say, small groups that meet throughout the week, and that's one of the good things that I want to say about them. I'm going to say some nice things about them in just a minute. But I just wanted to tell you what you're likely to see when you go to such a service. They do not use the Green Book at all, or they have not used the Green Book for months and months and months. When they build their new campus with the Crystal Cathedral, or whatever they're going to call it, there's going to be a chapel, a special chapel that seats 300 that's going to use the Green Book. Presumably. But I get the feeling that their heart is not in it. Yes.
It's a Lutheran church?
Yes, it is. It's a Lutheran church. You see that in our churches too, right? I mean, dreadful. Well, anyhow, the motive, as I have said, is to entice baby boomers, particularly into the mainline churches, and this is a phenomenon that's going to be striking the mainline churches, including your churches and your communities. The method is showbiz, as I say. The means is entertainment rather than participation. And then the seduction of numbers. You know, they want numbers. It's part of the church growth movement. If you know something about the church growth movement says churches do not grow if they are too diverse. Churches only grow if they're homogenous. All white, Anglo-Saxon, baby boomers, middle class. That church will grow. But if you begin to bring blacks in or Chicanos or whatever, they won't grow. No kids. No children. Ship them out. That's all part of the church growth movement, and they're right. I mean, my goodness, they have numbers to prove it. 6,000 members of this church. But I ask myself, is that all that we're interested in? Numbers? If you really want numbers, you should hire Madonna. Or Bruce Springsteen or somebody. You know, I mean, the seduction of numbers is... it's not sufficient for me just to say, hey, we're bigger, we got more members. I would hope that we are bringing people into the kingdom and initiating them into the gospel. And that means, from my perspective, the Catholic Church and the Catholic tradition, small c, diversity, lots of different people. Blacks and whites and old and young and left-wing and right-wing and gay and straight and little kids and old people and men and women. You want to see some differences? Look at men and women. I mean, there ought to be that kind of Catholic mix. If there is not that kind of Catholic mix, I'm suspicious. Well, having said all of that, let me say, what are they doing right? And then let me critique them. And then I will make some standards. If you want to move in this direction in your congregation, I give you my blessing, but I'm going to hold up some standards for you. Okay, what are they doing right? I got five things on my list. First, a vital enthusiasm in the leadership. And that is neat. The people who are up on stage in the entertainment evangelism in the Community Church of Joy, they really were filled with what they were doing. I mean, they thought that what they were doing was fun and exciting and good and helpful to people. I mean, you could tell that by the way they, you know, by the way they led worship. A vital enthusiasm in the leadership. And I said to myself, boy, wouldn't that be neat if we had that same kind of energy with the Green Book on Sunday morning in your church? So that's one thing they were doing right. Second thing they were doing right is their intention of hospitality. They wanted to make the church hospitable. And they had committees and they had people pressing the flesh and before the service began, the pastor himself was at the door, walking in among the pews, shaking people's hands 15 minutes before the service began. Wonderful. I heard from a Roman Catholic priest 20 years ago that it's more important for the priest to be at the door before the service begins than after the service is over. Because he's the host of the party, right? And he's greeting the people who come to the party in a personal way and saying, welcome, good to see you, where are you from? You know, that kind of stuff. And this pastor, several of the pastors at Community Church of Joy did that. And I thought that was dynamite. And again, I said to myself, why don't we see that happening among us on Sunday morning with the Green Book? Be terrific. Three, accessibility. Am I spelling this right? Accessibility, they wanted to make the service accessible to people. And I think that's a good motive. And so they had accessible music. They never used any hymns from the Green Book. It was all this kind of music. You know, and that's kind of fun, and it's accessible. You can learn it quickly. They use some of this at Holton Village, and I think that's splendid. Do you know the Tizé chants, the ostinatos from Tizé? They're wonderful. They're very accessible. You can learn them in a minute. But, oh, they're wonderful. I think that's great stuff, and we should have more of that. And I don't even mind a little bit of this on Sunday morning, too. You know, campfire, a youth event type songs. That's fine. I don't think I'd want a steady diet of that, because balanced with accessibility, I would want to balance durability. Something that lasts. And you can't do much better than, oh God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast. I mean, that's Isaac Watts. That's one of the great poets of the English language. That's wonderful stuff. Or the German chorales that are in here. 208. Sometime this week, take a look at hymn number 208. I teach this stuff. I've been teaching this for 5 years at seminary, but this was a new hymn to me. Can you imagine? This book has been out 15 years. And I first met this hymn a couple of years ago. Lord Jesus Christ, you have prepared this feast for my salvation. Zu Lebensbrot. Oh, wonderful hymn. It's a German chorale. It's not easy. It's not immediately accessible. You know, you have to be initiated into it. But if you have some enthusiasm in the leadership, including the musical leadership, and the pastor who's turned on by it, boy, oh boy, people will learn it. And that's going to last, that hymn. I'm not so sure about some of these other hymns, which strike me as very narcissistic. You know, it's me and Jesus, and I have the Spirit in my heart, and this is what I'm going to do for God. It's very subjective. Whereas a lot of the great hymns are objects. This is what God has done. Wonderful stuff. Anyhow, accessibility wants to be balanced with durability, but there's nothing wrong with accessibility, and we should try to make our service more accessible to people. And contemporizing. They wanted to use contemporary forms, and I think that's great too. I got nothing contemporary. I got nothing against contemporary. I do have some problems with all the technology, as I said yesterday. All these microphones and boomers and tweeters and amplification systems and so on. Oh boy, that's bad news. I think people are crying out for primary experience. Do away with all that stuff that interposes between you and me. The naked human voice, a flickering candle flame instead of artificial lights. Wonderful that stuff is, and that gets into your system, and you're fed by it in ways that, again, our grandparents could take for granted, but we can't anymore. Every little country church this big has to have a PA system. Dreadful. Okay, but contemporary, yes, sure, let's make the language contemporary. That's what this book does, for the most part. And let's use contemporary idioms of architecture and music and investments and all the rest. Finally, what's the word that I use? Assimilation, yeah. Follow-up and assimilation. They're apparently very good at that. Assimilation, is that right?
Close.
What have I done? Isn't that
right?
Anyhow, it means incorporating new people. They have a wonderful system at their church. When you're a new person, you walk in the door, boy, they follow up on you and they invite you to their small group or whatever it is, or their Bible study during the week. And they've got all kinds of activities going on during the week for your mothers and for fathers and for kids and so on. So all of that is very helpful and very valuable. And again, I would hope that our own churches would have some of that, more than some of it. Okay, what's wrong with entertainment evangelism? What's my critique? Well, I've got six critiques. Ritual contract is the first one. And as you might guess, we're going back to Kierkegaard with that. what are you being invited to do? Well, in entertainment evangelism, you're being invited to sit and watch a performance for the most part. And the participation of the people involved is really pretty minimal. And I think that's a mistake. So, what I would call, and this is a technical term, ritual contract. You are not being invited to be a performer on stage, but you're being invited to sit and watch. And I think that's deadly to Christian worship. Second, what I would call infantilization. We're being kept children, or worse yet, babies, by a lot of the stuff that they use, the hymns and the prayers and so on, the Jesus We Just type of prayers. The Jesus We Just type of prayers are okay around the campfire, and they're okay in your own personal private prayer. But I would be careful of using that kind of language in the prayers of the church. Likewise, the hymns, as I said, they were very much campfire hymns, like for youth events. And a little of that goes a long way. I'd be willing to have some of that on Sunday morning, but I would want to get to O God or Help in Ages Past, too, somewhere along the line. Go ahead.
I often feel that when you're talking about prayers there, I often think the prayers in the churches are made just for the adult people.
Mm.
And we overlook the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I often think that in our closing or in our prayers, we should have a couple simple ones there that the children can zero in on and understand.
Absolutely. That's accessibility, isn't it? You know, and I affirm all of that, and I think you're absolutely right and you're onto something. But having said that, I think we want to speak in the language of kids, and I have some nice words to say about children's sermons, for instance, the other day. Why is it that children's sermons are so popular with grown-ups? Well, they're simple. You know, there's one point. They use a lot of vigorous language, and you know, maybe even an object to make the point. All that is terrific. What have you got there?
Well, no, I'm just looking at a book like this.
Oh.
Adults like to hear children's stories.
Sure they do. Sure they do. For some good reasons. And so I'm not saying let's complexify things just for the sake of being complex, but I do think that the service that I attended at the Community Church of Joy kept everybody at the level of a little kid. And I said, gee, there wasn't much there to feed me as a grown-up. And, you want to be fed? Here's the prayer for the sixth Sunday after Pentecost. I didn't have to look at it. I memorized it long ago. Oh God, you have prepared for those who love you such good things as pass our understanding. Pour into our hearts such love for you that we, loving you above all things, may obtain what you promise, which exceeds all that we can ask or desire. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Isn't that a wonderful prayer? Now, that prayer has five parts. I mean, it's a kind of a classical collect form of prayer. And I think pastors ought to know that form. And grown-up Christian people ought to know that. And again, it's stretching us into maturity. St. Paul says that we are to grow up into mature adulthood. And I don't want to be kept a baby. The nice thing about being an adult is you can do this stuff and get down with the kids and enjoy that. But I wouldn't want to stay there. I would want to be stretched a little bit. And I think you'd agree with that. Okay, infantilization. Word reductionism is the next. These are all technical terms, aren't they? Word reductionism is my term for a view that says worship, reductionism. Worship is chiefly words. Words that you read, words that you pray, words that you sing, words that you read out of Scripture, words that are preached, and so on. And that, I got the feeling that this service at this congregation was not just non-sacramental, it was actively anti-sacramental. Again, I think Lutherans talk about word and sacrament. And what sacrament adds to word, as I said the other day, is molecules. When you eat and drink that bread and that wine, that goes into your system, you digest it, it goes into your metabolism. And that suggests to me that God wants to meet you at that level. God will not rest until the molecules are rescued. And the Holy Communion, you see, is a picture of God's beginning the rescue of even the molecules. And I'm talking about that pine tree that's dying out here, and I'm talking about the hole in the ozone layer, and I'm talking about the destruction of the rainforest in the Amazon. You see what I mean? In other words, it's incarnational. The Christian faith, it seems to me, is worried about stuff, about material, as much as it is about the spirit. And spirit is, what's her name, Phyllis was saying the other day, spirit and flesh are combined, and you cannot just separate that spirit and say, oh, God is just interested in the spirit and he's not interested in the molecules. God is interested in the molecules. That's why we have sacraments. And I felt that the service of the Community Church of Joy was not just word reductionist, it was actively anti-sacramental. They were not teaching sacramental life or incarnational living. They were not teaching a concern for that pine tree or the hole in the ozone layer or the destruction of the rainforest in the Amazon. Because they didn't have that incarnational sense that I think is essential in worship. Finally. Well, yeah, the ecumenical consensus. I pointed out yesterday that there is an ecumenical consensus that's building across the board in all Christian churches, and it's a wonderful consensus that we haven't seen since before the Reformation, and this worship is moving in the other direction. It's not within the ecumenical consensus, it's moving in some other side stream. Tanya,
what's the consensus?
Pardon?
What's the consensus?
The ecumenical consensus is a whole package of stuff that you can see, for instance, in this document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. Are you familiar with that document? You should look at it. I think they've got it in the bookstore, and they've got it here in the library, I'm certain. But it is an agreement by Roman Catholics, Anglicans, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists, even Pentecostals, and Greek Orthodox, about what baptism means, about what Holy Communion means, and what the ministry means. And we have not seen that kind of consensus for hundreds of years. And it is a new day. You are living in a new and wonderful day when Christian people can talk to each other like this across denominational lines. So, for instance, in worship, people are asking, all the denominations, asking the same questions, coming up with the same answers. You go to worship conferences the way I do, and you hear Anglicans, Roman Catholics, Presbyterians, etc., all of them talking my language. And that's an ecumenical consensus that's very thrilling and very exciting to me. And this stuff is not in that consensus. The consensus is, for instance, sacramental worship, incarnational worship. Almost all of the churches now are urging more frequent celebrations of the communion. Now, at the Community Church of Joy, they have the communion every now and then. I don't know how often. I think it's added on, you know, everybody's dismissed, and then if people want to hang around, why, they can have communion. I think they'll do it that way. But that's not the ecumenical consensus. Ecumenical consensus is every Sunday, word and sacrament. Dear, dear, I'm going to, I can't even get to my final section. I'll forget my final section and do it next time. Let's have some conversation. You began it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is there's a very exciting agreement among all the mainline churches about what worship is, about what the gospel is. You know, talk about theology and ethics and so on. Some wonderful consensus. And there was a hand, yeah.
If this started with 200 people and probably 5,800 who didn't go to church before,
well,
you know, I wonder, you know, I just kind of think, you know, what would God think about 5,800 people who didn't have a spiritual life,
yeah,
who were at least coming someplace,
yeah,
every Sunday to, mm-hmm, think about maybe being a little bit nicer to the person next to them?
I suppose I should hand that to them, and I should say that they have a system that's kind of two-track. In other words, this is what they're moving toward. This service that I went to, that's for the seekers. And then, presumably, there's another service on Wednesday night or something for the ones who found it. I got some problems with that, but maybe there's something to be said for a service that just attracts people who have no background. This is the point they're making. They have no, they are attracting people who have no church background.
There are a lot of baby boomers that are actively, I mean, that are made extremely uncomfortable by religion.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I the number of people who think it's weird that I go to church, I know, pretty big. And I keep thinking, is this all bad? It's clear that my religion, Lutheranism, hasn't been welcoming enough to make other people feel anything other than kind of nervous about the fact that, we are something that's an organized religion.
Yeah.
Or I am something.
That's as much a judgment on your church, isn't it? And on the way.
Oh, our church,
that's bad news. This gal and then this fellow.
Okay, where are the fundamentalists fit into this? Are they attracted to that?
Oh yeah, they've had that all along. You see, it's kind of a Baptist tent revival meeting, isn't it?
Okay.
What I described for you has been going on since frontier days.
Yeah, okay.
Among the Baptists and among some others. So, I can see where people think, oh gee, that's religion, or that's what worship is. But I think the Lutherans and Anglicans and Roman Catholics and so on have something to offer in their pointing out that it's word and sacrament, and that there's other virtues besides simple accessibility that we ought to be concerned with. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but there, as you pointed out in an earlier lecture, they're a different kind of Quaker.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, are we excluding that kind of thinker?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to exclude anybody. And I would want to make my service so lively and so full of life and so transparent to the gospel that even the seekers and the secularists and the people who had no church background could come and at least get something out of it. Now, they would have to be initiated into some of it. What do those colors mean? Why is he wearing green up there? That kind of thing. But I think it's worth making that effort myself. I maybe not answered you.
Well, I'm relating this to something personal in our family.
Sure.
Somebody, a fundamentalist who has sampled it, doesn't like it.
Yeah.
I mean, just doesn't think that way. Doesn't see the symbolism. It's not. They put it. They're not being fed.
Well, and I suppose in America you can pay your money and take your choice, can't you?
Yeah.
It's very much a volunteer thing, you don't like what the Lutherans offer,
really
you go to the Baptist.
Be all things to all people.
Yeah, that'd be difficult. Roman Catholics have managed it down through the ages. Now, lately they're in more trouble, but I could explain that too if we had time. At least I think I could. This fellow and this fellow.
I think when you started, you said you had 6 points?
I was cutting things short here.
Oh, yeah.
Ecumenical consensus. Finally, I have said, is it good entertainment and is it good evangelism? I'm not sure it is very good entertainment. We were with musicians at this time when we visited, and they said, gee, this is really not contemporary music. It's 1960s rock and roll or something, and now the new contemporary music is quite different, so it wasn't very, and it wasn't performed all that well either, quite frankly, so I didn't think it was all that great entertainment. And evangelism, again, is initiating people into the fullest truth about God. This would be my answer to the Baptists and the fundamentalists. That the fullest truth about God is word and sacrament. And people may not be ready for that or may find that offensive. But I think that's what we have. Pardon me, the sixth point then would be, what is my sixth point? Oh, is it divisive in the parish? Yeah, does it teach scorn for our tradition? I think it does.
Why?
Who said that?
Why?
Why?
Why is it? We go through the same thing in school, education. We go from this end of the pendulum way over this way. We throw the whole baby, the bathwater and the baby out together. Then it's back to this 20 years later. Then it's back to this. Why? People are different. We're supposed to reach people where they are, not say, here we are, you come to us, this is where we are. Why can't we go where different people are? Why can't the people in the parish realize that not everybody is going to be reached by the same preaching, by the same music, by the same type of service? Why can't we have different ones? Why do we have to have this, you know, it's got to be this. This is where the most of people want to come, so we do this. We don't care about the rest of you. So they go off and join a different church because it meets them. But maybe it really isn't doing what we could do for them if we could just get over this idea that our faith is founded more on how many types of hymns we sing out of the Green Book than out of something else.
You want to respond to that?
Well, I saw it for
two. I'm going to have to leave because my son.
Yeah, sure.
Son-in-law and daughter just came in on the bus, so I'm not running off because I don't want to
get you. Okay, right, we got to continue this.
I had a joke. My son, who is an elder in a congregation, is dealing with a conflict between the pastor who is really struggling to be evangelistic, you know, and trying some of the new things. And they are attracting some new people. And the altar guild is up in arms because they're having communion more often, they're having services more often.
You gotta wash those linens more often.
And a conversation with the head of the altar guild, a lady said to my son, who are all these new people and why can't they go to the Presbyterian Church two blocks down? And he replied, well, Joyce, what is the Great Commission? And there was a pause. Well, I'm just not up on what Synod has been doing lately.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Oh, yeah, sure, we should try to appeal, I think, to everybody and say what we've got is great. And let's learn from everybody. I think we can do that. Go ahead.
Well, I think we are in a church situation where we have a pastor and a choir director. Since we've been there, I'm not sure we've had two services the same.
Really? All right.
But yet we use the Green Book. But we're not bound by how that service is structured in that Green Book.
That's the last thing I would say too. You know, I don't
we're
want
not bound by that. But we use some vital important things out of it, but we don't use everything out of it. And we pull hymns from there a lot, but we're also printing up hymns in the bulletin from other sources that are more. I'm not a scholar person, more of a modern type. Song. We have once a year, sometimes twice a year, where the service is a total children's program. Mm-hmm. A couple months ago with Noah's Ark. That was the whole church service. Mm-hmm. Or the music machine. The whole church service. We didn't have a sermon. We didn't have the liturgy. We had a good benediction, I guess, to close the service. But that's the one that came out of the Green Book that Sunday, the benediction.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an old guy, but there's a lot of young couples in there now that I think are feeling, hey, there's something here for us too. And my wife and I, with the old gray hair, we're saying, hey, there's something that's for here too, and it's still keeping some of the old stuff we had.
Yeah, I have heard.
I sometimes say, I wish the Bishop Chilton could come and put this out and say, take a look at the liturgical shepherd.
And I've used liturgical dance in my services and drama. We did Noah's Flood too, as a matter of fact. I don't think I would want to do away with the rest of the service and have the whole thing Noah's Flood for me. I think I want the Noah's Flood as a kind of a let's say, a sermon in lieu of sermon as a commentary on the scriptures or whatever, and then move on to communion and the prayers and so on. But again, I wouldn't want to be slavish about that book.
No, it's the Noah's Ark. That was the whole service done by the children. And it's open. I mean, it's not every Sunday. It's not one Sunday a month. It's twice a year maybe we do this.
We have to listen to this fellow. Let me get out of here.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, we certainly go wrestle this in our church too. I think we have to be more responsive to members, people voting with their feet. And that. But on the other hand, you know, I think perhaps you're saying this too, is you know, look at what the Community Church of Joy has done and recognize that they've done a lot of good
things.
They
got some good stuff, sure.
They got some very good things, and that if you can take the good things and still retain some of the things that you find important, then I think you've got the best of both worlds.
I'll agree to that.
It's saying that there are those people are out there, they're searching, they're wanting something.
Sure.
We just have to find the compromise between what they've done and what we feel comfortable with ourselves.
Well, the thing is concerning about a church like this, again, looking me old way there now, I don't know if I could have this every Sunday.
Yeah,